This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is August 22nd, 2019. This is episode 152. Politicos is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple dollars a month at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott DeLundeboom.
I'm Ian Bushfield, and today we're joined by
Maria Dobritskaya
and Leslie Bolt
from Call the Question. Welcome to Politicos.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
On today's show, we're going to be talking with you about the story that's almost dead by now, that climate change is a partisan issue, whether the Liberals are going to face further consequences for shutting down the Ethics Committee again. And I guess the bigger question, can politicians change their mind? I think there's a series of stories that we can tie that into. Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcumbiatoday.ca. So Maria and Leslie, Call the Question is, I think, everyone in BC Poly's new favorite podcast.
We certainly hope
so. That's a very warm introduction there. We certainly hope so. I mean, we don't need to be people's favorites, but we want to be on their queue for sure. We're happy to share that spot with you guys. There's certainly lots of space in the BC political landscape, I think, for more voices. And that was the motivation for us to pull Call the Question together. Yeah.
So could you elaborate on that? Why did you start Call the Question?
Well, Maria and I have been very good friends for a long time. We're both very interested in politics, and we have political conversations all the time. But we also would talk a lot about how the kinds of things that we wanted to talk about or get into deeper conversations on weren't really happening. And so I think over a year ago, I said to Maria, we should start our own podcast.
Took me a little while. Not that I was opposed to it, but of course, it took us a little while. But our main focus is wanting to really profile more women. There's a lot of women in politics. There's more women as political staffers, more women elected, more women in the press gallery, which is great.
Yeah.
But the people who are still tend to dominate the political narrative tend to still be men. And so we wanted to create a space that we're able to bring more women together, talk about the experience of women in politics, and highlight some of the exciting things that are going on in BC and bring more voices into the mix.
And women are experts too, right? And there's so many incredible women politicians, as Maria said, women that are working in the back rooms, that are working as political staff, that are in cabinet, for Pete's sake. But we just don't hear enough from them. And we don't also hear about their stories. And we love politics, and we want other people to love politics too. And so hopefully, like, some of these conversations that we're having, some of the issues that we talk about, inspire other people that aren't involved in politics to get involved.
So you just wrapped off your first series, and the finale was a great recap of the entire series. So I recommend people just listen to that. But maybe just very briefly, what was the big highlight for each of you? What's the must listen to episode?
Oh, we have to pick favorites. I mean, it's hard. I think that Leslie and I, just as new podcasters, got better, tighter, you know, as we went through the season. So, I'm very grateful to our early guests for their patience with us. And it is hard for me to pick a favorite. I really liked the episode that we had with the Portland Hotel Society women, Coco Culbertson and Dr. Christy Sutherland, talking about the opioid crisis. It was the only episode we did with two guests, which was also a challenge.
It was a first.
Yeah.
For us.
And,
yeah.
But I mean, partly for me, it's just that it's an issue that I'm quite passionate about and I think we need a lot more attention to. But they were both just so clear and direct. And it was a really good highlight of women on the front lines in various ways. I like them all, though. I really do. I don't want to.
You know, I'll say, and I love them all, too. And each one of them brought something really special and unique. I would say, for me, I mean, I think we had a lot of fun with Lisa Yuzda from News 1130. We could have talked twice as long as we did. And we'll probably have her back at some point because we just had such a great time with her. Patty Backus is a good friend of both of ours. And so that was easy for us, I think, because we knew her story, but we knew lots of other folks didn't. And Berinda Rissotti, the former Surrey City Councillor and mayoral candidate, I said on our wrap-up episode that I feel like, you know, Berinda really had a chance to reclaim her political story after being out of politics for a few years. And it was really fun to be a part of that.
So now that Leslie's mentioned almost, I feel like I got to give Nicholas Sperling and Nadine Nakagawa a shout out as well, just to round out our first season. And I'll just say, like, one of the things that was interesting and that we've grappled with, and we've already sort of talked about moving beyond a little bit, but is how common, you know, all of these women came from very, very different perspectives to a certain extent. They're all women in politics, but how you define their involvement in politics was varied. And being able to sort of highlight the common experience of women in spaces that historically and sometimes currently are not really built for them, I think was really good. And it was a common thread. And each of them brought something that was both unique and that also really highlighted that there is some systemic issues at play.
And we can't forget, of course, our first guest, Ginger Gosnell-Myers. Yeah. That's still our top-rated episode, and it was a real thrill for us to chat with her and get her perspective. So
listen to them all.
Listen to them all.
And thanks, you guys, for giving us this this time and space to profile these women and our podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. So what's next for Call the Question? When does Series 2 drop, and what can we look forward to in it?
Well, we're going to be recording our next episode next week, in fact, our first episode of the new series. So we're really excited about that. We really want to focus on what we're calling innovators and disruptors. And yes, they'll probably be women who we really feel like are helping to change the conversation, change the channel, not just on women in politics, but on the issues in which they're experts. And so you're going to see a different kind of guest this series. People that are doing really interesting, cutting edge stuff that are taking on the establishment and winning.
Patriarchy. We have to say the patriarchy.
Well, let's just call it. It's the patriarchy. And winning. And they're winning.
Where can people find the podcast and where can they support the podcast?
Well, if you want to learn more about our podcast and find out where to find us, you can go to boltcommunications.com. That's boltcommunications.com/podcast or find us on the homepage. You'll find links there. You can find us on Google Play, iTunes, Spreaker, and
where podcasts are.
You could also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Call the Q Podcast.
You could support us on Patreon at patreon.com/callthequestion.
That's
right. Is that right?
Yep.
Well, let's jump into today's topics. The story that's almost dead by now is this, is climate change a partisan issue? This kicked off at the start of the week with news that I guess Elections Canada officials had been suggesting that since Maxime Bernier has been questioning the science and fact that we're in a climate crisis, that that might make it an issue in this election, in which case any nonprofits or third parties who wanted to advertise that climate change is real and we should do something about it might need to register, and that that might be considered a partisan issue.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that issue, the story might be out of the news cycle, but I suspect it will reemerge one way or another. And we saw, you know, is it Elections Canada to blame? Is their interpretation too
literal?
Small c conservative. You know, is it the legislation itself? This is legislation that's been in place for a long time. So, and it is up to Elections Canada to interpret it. But their interpretation, I think, is, you know, I think there does need, it's a challenging issue, actually, I think, because if Elections Canada is not determining what issues are the politicians determining that? Like, is Parliament determining that? To me, the obvious way to go in that situation is when you have all of the other parties. I mean, I think that the fact that there is this kind of consensus is what people found so ridiculous about it. But I think what it really highlights is just how complicated this election might be. How do we keep there? You know, Elections Canada is very vigilant around the third party spending. And I think there's obviously really important reasons for that to be the case. And like a lot of policy, is this the, you know, you throw it out there, you do, it does most of what you want it to do, but then there's unforeseen circumstances. One of the things that I heard earlier this week, I think it was Front Burner, the CBC's Front Burner, was this woman from that was the first time that I'd heard this that actually shifted my opinion a little bit. Because initially, I'll admit, I thought, okay, everybody's making a little bit too much of a big deal about this. And I say that as somebody who has worked on campaigns, who has had to deal with filing report, you know, not with Elections Canada, more so locally, but a lot of it seemed standard to me. I think the fact that there has already been an attack on charities from the previous Harper government or the CRA, maybe attack, I'm embellishing the using the word attack, but stricter rules for charities around
political activity
yeah. is certainly part of where the concern comes. But apparently this woman who was from, I think it was It's Evidence for Democracy, it's an organization wanting to put science at the forefront of decision making, go figure. She made a really good point that in the last election in 2015, where they did not register as a third party, they went out and did the work that they do, the nonpartisan work, evidence-based work that they do. But the issue of science itself was actually a political issue during the campaign. Harper muzzling scientists, mm-hmm. there was all of that, you know. So I thought that was an interesting, and that wasn't interpreted as an issue to avoid. So,
well, and part of it, there's so many like different layers of mm-hmm. whose mistake was this? Because the Liberals did bring in some changes last year, but those seem to not be changing the definition. And then there's also, because I kept trying to figure this story out, because like you, I work in nonprofits. And so it's professional duty to know these things.
Yeah.
And Elections Canada's website's intermittently using partisan advertising or election advertising or partisan or electoral advertising. And you're like, which one is it?
Well, and the mm-hmm. definition of partisan from Elections Canada versus what's partisan from the Canada CRA. Revenue Agency are different, right? So that's where some of these nonprofits... They can't declare they're doing partisan activity for Elections Canada, because then what does that do to their charitable status?
And I think that this particular issue, though, I think is a lightning rod, because you have people denying that climate change is happening when the vast body of science it proves that it is. And so it sounds extra absurd that in some case, in some way, you might get in trouble if you actually say that in advertising. It makes no sense.
Yeah, I think that's kind of why it bubbled up to the surface.
100%,
and this one struck a chord. And the way it was phrased in the Elections Canada material makes it sound like, you know, once any candidate at any level talks about something, mm-hmm. then that potentially gets involved. And, you know, where does that limit fall? And, you know, the Rhinoceros Party, for example, has done...
The first time I ever retweeted the Communist Party of Canada, maybe the only time, but they actually had a very humorous tweet about not believing that the markets are the best way to deliver goods and services, and so therefore can the Fraser Institute not participate in the election, which I thought was funny.
Kind of funny, yeah.
Or at least... They can register and then be subject to
limits. They'd have to register. But they also have charitable status, right? Yeah. So that is, you know.
And as a professional communicator, I thought it was humorous that Elections Canada came back with this sort of very, you know, bureaucratic response that it's a complaint-based process. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? So some... You know, not very...
You get the yellow vesters deciding to make...
Yeah, I don't even know what the word is, but an uninformed person, a highly uninformed person could complain, and that could somehow trigger a process where you couldn't talk about climate change. Again, the absurdity of it, I think, is one of the reasons it became such a big story.
Yeah, it's kind of rife for abuse with that, because
totally. It's
100%. An election. Everybody's trying to find any little edge they can get.
That's right.
Well, even Maxime Bernier said that, like, I mean, he's inconsistent in his libertarian ideology at the best of times, but he was consistent in that regard of being like,
we should be able to talk about anything. Yeah.
And it was a good, easy win for him. And
Totally. Win-win in general.
I think it probably killed the story,
actually.
It was
so much
you know, it took
attention.
The wind out of the sails.
And I faced similar restrictions in British Columbia, but the BC laws at the provincial and local levels don't call it partisan advertising. They mm-hmm. have your, like, direct sponsor of a political party, or you're an issues-based
Issues. Well, I think that's the use of the word partisan is also what really tripped people up for that very reason, right? And it's, again, because of the differing definitions, even organizations that might otherwise register and didn't had the capacity within their organization to do so, because that also came up a lot. People were like, well, it's not that hard to register. And it's true, it's not that hard to register, but there's you know, there's responsibilities that come with that around filing and opening a bank account. And for a small nonprofit, like that's a lot of capacity.
We should probably also mention that this is for election advertising over $500. Just so you talking still, about stuff.
Well, this is exactly it. Because that also got conflated, I think, in a lot of the coverage, because we live in this Twitter outrage. People see the headline and what do you mean I can't talk about climate change for the next month and a half? You can talk about it. You can do interviews. You could, but I think it's hard in the cluttered landscape of so much information to get your information through without frankly putting some money behind it. Yeah. So people can still talk about it. But in some ways, I think this is helpful to the government, to be frank. I mean, people talk about it being helpful to Scheer, to Bernier. But I think the, you know, having the parties directing the climate conversation certainly is in the interest of the government.
And I hope it opens up a bit more discussion about these nuances in our elections laws. Because when I looked at some of the BC ones, they are much more severe in terms of there were, like, one of the reasons my charity was quiet during the election campaign or the local election campaigns. We wanted to talk about property taxes, but I asked Elections BC and they said, well, if any politicians start talking about it, then it'll be an issue. And I'm like, so if our campaign is successful, we'll have to register, track our donors, report our donors, make sure our donors are all Canadian or British Columbian and don't give us more than $1,200. Yeah. I don't want to do that.
After
I work by myself.
Yeah, and because as you say, you're trying to get an issue on the political radar and agenda and in the public conversation. So yeah, if you're successful, then
And it's that if someone talks about it, then that adds a layer of uncertainty here, which they'd also create a lot of problems because it's hard to tell necessarily if you're going to be subject to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, there were, 200 people running in the Vancouver municipal election? Oh, someone talked about everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why it has to be complaint-driven, because how do you keep track of it all? I think that paying attention to dark money and third-party advertising and all of that is really critical, and people are anxious about it, I think, for good reason. I'm not quite sure this is helpful in that larger conversation, though.
Totally.
Moving on to our next segment, the Ethics Committee met this week to talk about the report we talked about last week and that was released last week on the Ethics Commissioner's findings regarding Trudeau's involvement in the SNC-Lavalin affair. So they met Wednesday, didn't last all that long because the Liberals decided, we don't need to hear from the Ethics Commissioner on his very explosive report.
Isn't this the first time that a committee has not given I don't know what the proper word, you know, has not given time to a officer of parliament to speak to their report? I think that I saw that this is the only time that this has happened.
Could be. We'll have to let the parliamentary history
nerds
confirm that.
People will tweet at us.
It was
an interesting vote, though, because the Liberals used their majority to stop Dion from speaking, but one Liberal actually did break ranks, and that was Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, the rebel of the caucus, who someone posted the how often do people vote against their party, and I think he was the most rebellious at...
Liberals, I think.
I think maybe everyone.
Of anybody. There's very few people voting
on side with his team about 95% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But arguably some push more behind the scenes in caucus or something.
That's what they say anyway.
The interesting thing though for me with Erskine Smith is his reasoning for voting against his party and voting to have the commissioner there wasn't that he thought the commissioner was right. It's that he wanted to grill them on how wrong he was. Mm-hmm. And Erskine Smith posted a long Facebook post calling it a legally wrong judgment. And, you know, the jobs are important. Why can't that be considered in this ruling?
That's so interesting. Yeah.
Which differs from the other Liberals solely in the fact that they also thought the Ethics Commissioner screwed up all the laws, but they didn't want to talk to them about it.
Yeah, nobody wanted the clip of the Ethics Commissioner. Nobody in the Liberal Party wanted the clip of the Ethics Commissioner.
No, they want this story to go away as soon as possible. And I think if it was up to them, it wouldn't have reemerged last week like it did.
And I don't know, other than, you know, those of us who pay attention to this stuff in the dog days of summer, I don't think that many people care. I mean, that's the unfortunate part, right? We didn't see any bump. We didn't see any shifts at all in the story after the Ethics Commissioner report came out. And I think a lot of that is because people had already decided where they were going to land on this earlier this year.
They confirmed their existing biases around this story.
But I mean, it's concerning. Yeah. I think a lot of it is just there's a cynicism around politicians in general. It's like, well, they all break the rules, and this guy doesn't, you know, he's not Trump, right? Like, that's the baseline now for ethical behavior in office.
I think one of the major concerns here is that people will just check out of politics altogether. Yeah. They'll just be, pox on all your houses. And that could really, you know, affect. And I think that concerns me I'm sure everyone here, that people won't come out to the polls because they'll just say, screw you, you know?
Well, the narrative around Trudeau is this quasi-corrupt disappointment from his 2015 image. And then the narrative around the other leaders is who?
Yeah, exactly.
Which
in a way is good for the Liberals, right? Because of all the options, it's the highest profile, right?
So it just means a low turnout election, which is kind of disappointing for all of us who care about democracy.
For democracy in general, for Canadian democracy.
Well, and I think there's a lot of that started, frankly, at the beginning of the Trudeau's term, right? There was a lot of promises made that were not kept. And so he came in, I think, really igniting a lot of young people who were happy to see Harper go, who were excited about a lot of the platform commitments that the Liberals had, who wanted real change. And I don't know how many of those people are coming back. And, you know.
I think where this story will play out is in Vancouver Granville.
Yeah.
And I live in that riding, and so I'll have an opportunity to vote.
That's a valuable vote.
But you've got two fairly high-profile, capable candidates in Jody Wilson-Raybould, the independent, and the replacement Liberal candidate in Talib Nur Muhammad. And it'll be really interesting to see how Wilson-Raybould tries to keep this story going locally. I think there's a lot of local media interest in the story as well. Maybe not nationally, but certainly here in Vancouver. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
She still has a book coming out.
I'm sure
she's not done yet. Yeah. She's not done.
Another media cycle to this.
The timing of that.
The other thing coming up in the middle of the campaign, or at least on September 20th, I think, is SNC goes to court.
Well, there's that.
Whether that reignites it as well, which is going to be an interesting thing.
I think there's enough. I mean, part of it is that it's complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like the $16 glass of orange juice, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's a certain sort of symbolic things that we see are politicians spending money on or wasting money on, and it's clear how to. This one is not, if you're not paying attention, it's Quebec, it's Trudeau,
it's legal stuff.
I don't know. Did he break the law? You know, and but Scheer is.
We don't really have any good leaders in the opposition who are really capable of selling the public on why it's a problem.
It's really disappointing.
It's a big missed opportunity. Yeah. Like, with this Ethics Commissioner report coming out, first of all, Scheer, and I said this in February, March, or whenever it was, I thought he went out way too soon with a Trudeau must resign. Like, that's like, what else?
There's nothing in the kit bag.
I mean, the NDP was the one who wrote the letter to the Ethics Commissioner and then called for a public inquiry. And they should have been reminding everybody of that this week. Like, they should have taken credit, I think, for the fact that this report was produced or something, or pushed it. But
they could have hammered. Jagmeet Singh could have hammered the Liberals a lot more on this than I think he did. Yeah.
Yeah, we're really missing someone with Mulcair's skills the government in question period and on the campaign trail.
Yeah, and a number of our friends commented on that there are leaders of parties past who would have done way more with this than what we've seen. And it is disappointing. And again, not just for politics, but also for our democracy.
Well, I think I saw Scheer put out a call for the RCMP to investigate, which everyone immediately pointed out is the same kind of prosecutorial interference that...
Let the RCMP do their job.
Yeah. So,
totally.
The story's not dead yet, but
I don't know that it's
no. I'm with Maria on this one. I don't know if it's going to have national influence. I do think it'll have some influence locally.
Yeah, I think it's a vote depressant more than anything else.
Well, mentioning Mulcair, let's talk about politicians changing their minds.
Good old Tom.
Let's start with Tom Mulcair. He has a piece in the Toronto Sun that I just read on my way here where he's pumping up Elizabeth May. And he's not officially endorsing her, as far as I can tell, but he is talking about how she's the leader with the most experience. She has a big opportunity here. And the thing that just jumps out for me is, well, this is novel. Usually the NDP leaders who want to stab their party in the back go to the Liberals.
I don't know what to say. I mean, here's what I'll Quebec. Say. Here's as I think say. That the Greens nationally, even in British Columbia, have not lived up to the hype or the promise that we thought even just a few months ago. It looked like they had momentum and they were trying to you know, throw some kindling on that fire. And
well, the by-election gave them a big bump, but they were able to put entire resources of a national campaign into one riding.
That's right.
And it just
in the polling numbers, but also in the narrative, in the media, you name it, the Greens are not kind of delivering that kind of momentum that everyone was saying, all the pundits, the regular pundits, were saying that they were. And so we haven't seen that. So I don't want to, like, guess at what Tom Mulcair is motivated by in writing a piece like that, but I don't agree with him.
Yeah, I don't entirely agree with him either. And I think part of it is that Elizabeth May is as much a problem with the Green Party as anything else.
100%.
I think a more skilled leader, even one with less experience, probably would have been able to make more of the momentum that occurred.
Yeah.
Both from what's already been mentioned and the fact that several provincial legislatures now have Greens holding balances of power, two of them, and seats in another couple.
It's an excellent point. They should be able to do more with that.
Their brand is strong, right? Yeah. It's really, really strong. But there's a disconnect, I think, between the strength of their brand and then what they do in government, not in government, in parliament or in legislatures.
Well, with May's current leadership, she does have one other good news story, which is that former NDP MP Pierre Nantel, who was kicked out of the party, I think, in the last week for secret conversations with another party.
Yeah.
Turns out which one that is.
Yeah. Was the Greens, and now he's going to be running for them in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. It's been a while since we've had a floor crosser.
So he hasn't officially crossed the floor because he's sitting as an independent but going to run as a Green, because I think the Greens have the ethos, at least now, I think historically they have accepted floor crossers when it allows them to get into debates, of that you should resign and rerun kind of grassroots democracy.
Have they done that just when Paul Heyer?
That's what I mean. Yeah, they accepted him just so they could get Bruce mm-hmm. Bruce Heyer.
Bruce Heyer?
It's amazing
how
politics does that to people.
Doing politics differently.
Well, and not to be like the public relations person in the room, but I'm going to be that person again. Like, I think this was just badly played. Like,
I think the NDP did actually well on this.
This is exactly
getting
it was badly
ahead of
played
it.
By the Greens, yeah. And because it could have been one of those signs of momentum that they were creating to show that they're overtaking the NDP, blah blah blah. But even just you describing this process, well, we have to sit in as an independent, and then he has to get nominated as a Green. It and the way it was handled, these secret conversations that clearly somebody found out about, it's just all very sloppy, and it's kind of landed with a thud. So unfortunately, I don't think the Greens are going to get a lift out of this.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think the NDP did well in getting out ahead of it, kicking him out, basically, and kind of took some of the air out of that. But there's more to that story. It's not just that he wants to fight the climate change, right?
Well, yeah, Nantel had, and this is something a lot of New Democrats are very quick to point out on Twitter, had been very critical, not directly of Jagmeet Singh during the leadership race, but had pointed out in his own words that ostentatious religious symbols are, quote, incompatible with power.
Ostentatious.
I don't know if he used the word ostentatious,
okay.
But
still.
He definitely
he did
said
something
religious.
Like that. That was a visible displays of, you know, in line with the conversation that's been going on in Quebec. But then what happened when he was standing beside Elizabeth May?
The photo they chose is him almost like staring at the crucifix on her chest.
That mm-hmm. she always wears, mm-hmm. always, which is fine because people having faith is okay
and this
in
is
political
Canada.
Office.
Yeah.
But you have to be a white person, I think, in order to get away with ostentatious displays of religious symbols or something.
Or at least Christian.
Christian. Yeah. Christian. Fair enough. Fair enough, Christian. It's true.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were quite quickly critical of that and highlighting that.
And rightly so. Rightly so. I mean, if at least be consistent, if you're going to not that I agree with him in any way, but at least be consistent.
I don't know what that will mean in Quebec. He won not by that much.
It was 703 votes in 2015.
Yeah.
I had to look this up. So he did get over 50% of the vote in 2011. But a
that
lot
was
of
the
new
orange
Democrats.
Way. Yeah, the that Quebec.
Was,
may he rest in peace. That's the credit to Jack Layton.
And frankly, to the fact that the Liberals were
had collapsed.
And Michael Ignatieff.
And the Bloc.
Michael Ignatieff. I forgot about him.
But yeah, 700 votes last time, and with a Liberal behind him. So
yeah, just behind him. And the Greens got not even 1,500 votes,
right,
clearing less than 2.5%.
Right.
Yeah. I have no idea what the Greens in Quebec,
think they could have made a little bit more hay out of this than
I think that they will. The Greens will benefit to a certain extent from Liberal voters who can't themselves to vote for Trudeau because of the ethics stuff or other broken promises. In the same way, I think we saw here in BC with people who were not going to vote for Christy Clark in the last election, but couldn't bring themselves to vote New Democrat. I think a lot of those votes went Green. And I think we'll see a certain amount of that in this election, but not in Quebec. I mean, I think that for all of whatever impact, if any, the SNC-Lavalin stuff has had outside of Quebec, it's consistently actually played quite well for the Liberals all the way from February till now. So,
well, if the election does turn out to be a minority, the other thing the NDP came out with this week is that they're not going to prop up a conservative minority government.
Yeah.
Did anyone expect they would?
Well, I think I remember Jack Layton getting some blowback around musing about that, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's always something that, I mean, it's horse trading, right? In a first past the post system with that minority government, what can you extract? What can you make the government do? And yeah, I think there's a lot more of a natural alignment between the Liberals and the NDP, not because I think they should be in the same party, but because the Liberals say they're going to do a lot of things that the NDP would then make them do that they might not otherwise do. I don't know. I mean, I think I saw some people questioning whether that was a good move for Jagmeet. One of the things that it does do is position him as somebody with ethics, which I think is not a bad position for him to be emphasizing, given the
especially
given
over the past
context.
Couple of weeks. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I wouldn't say ethics, but principles.
Principles. Yeah.
The ethics could come up if you say, well, why would he support who he's repeatedly called an unethical prime minister?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the reasons, you know, Jack Layton voted against Paul Martin's government and then supported, I think, the initial move of Stephen Harper's was that, you know, we need to clean house, get the Liberals out. Harper ran on accountability in 2004 and 2006, and so starting that trend to change things.
Because, yeah, the Liberals have been in power for 13 years at that point. The public mood was a lot different.
We need
than
term
it is
limits.
Now.
I'm in favor of term limits. That's conversation.
terrible idea. Okay. Barack Obama would be president right now if term limits didn't exist south of the border.
That's a
I like to say Robert Reagan might still be president in that case.
Can we go back? But you had opened this segment with the question about politicians being able to change their minds. And I actually, because I know that came up today also in the federal news cycle. I personally think they should. I like it when politicians change their mind, not in terms of a flip-flop, but coming to a position that they didn't historically support because they've listened, they've learned, their eyes have been open, the times have changed. Sometimes it's more crass than that. That's where the votes are. They weren't there before. But I do think that, you know, the response, the public response, often the media's response to any politician changing their mind is to call them a flip-flopper, they're inconsistent and all of this. And that doesn't actually encourage our elected officials to make good decisions, to evolve beyond historical bad positions that they may have held. And I mean, I think we saw the federal Liberals released a clip today of Andrew Scheer from a decade ago?
2005, during the debate over the civil marriage
in
act.
In that video,
clearly taking a position, opposing same-sex marriage. And of course, the conservatives then came out with a long list of liberal MPs who had also opposed it at that time. I don't think the issue is that he opposed it 15 years ago. I think the issue is he hasn't been seen in a pride parade and hasn't made any clear statements in support of LGBTQ rights in this current context.
And this clip really just kind of validates and supports what people believe his position to be.
Yeah. The conservatives get, you know, the lowest credit for removing the opposition to same-sex marriage from their party platform, I think, last year?
I think it was
the year before.
2015 convention?
Worryingly recently.
Yeah.
But they, you know, have still spoken out, and I think Scheer had been on the record of saying, I would repeal Bill C-16 because free speech or something about being scared of trans people. So there's still some questions about his record that I think are worth asking.
Yeah.
And a little bit better than that thing you said 15 years ago.
Totally.
There are a lot of smart people in the conservative war room. Like, they have to know this is a problem for them.
A vulnerability
for them.
Yeah.
And I think it says something that they haven't tried to shore this up too much. And whether that's coming from their boss or where else.
I think it's Maxime Bernier, to tell you the truth. I think that the one or two or three, I mean, I don't see him really being able to pull off much in this next election.
No.
But, you know, I also don't see the conservatives being able to break 37-38% or wherever they've been. I think that 1 or 2% is enough to potentially have impact in October. And so they're, you know, they're maybe catering a little bit more to social conservatives in their big tent than they might otherwise.
Yeah, you've definitely seen them try and close any gap between themselves and Bernier to deprive his party of oxygen. But there is stuff they could do with their own record, which don't think would actually hurt them. They had a big push during Harper's last term around LGBT refugees. I'm sure their base would love a chance to talk down about Iran and stuff like that where they could talk up their own record on the issue in at least ways that don't hurt them further and shore up the weakness they have a bit.
I think that would be a tough needle to thread, though, because those same social conservatives are not pro-immigration or refugees. And as you know, there are refugees fleeing domestic violence or hate-based violence in other countries. But again, it's a tricky thread, a needle to thread. It's like, we're not pro-immigration except for these vulnerable people over here. So I can see why they'd probably be not touching that hot potato either.
I mean, I also just think that wing of the party, social conservatives in general, are emboldened, right? Like what we've seen across this country, what we've seen in this province, and certainly obviously south of the border, is scary, right? So it makes it an issue that is ripe for the liberals, frankly, to fearmonger around. But also, I think within the conservatives, there's people that see opportunity if the conservatives
get elected. I think the Tories have really boxed themselves in here. Like, they don't really have a lot of room to move. They can't go too any more progressive than they are. They can't go too, too right wing or too conservative or get into this sort of scary racist, bigoted kind of area. And so, and there's a lot of commentaries around that. It's like, there's no real room for growth. They might be reinforcing their base, but are they able to get those 2 or 3 or 4% they would need to get some kind of a majority?
And do they even have a leader that's inclined or capable of doing that?
And I think the answer to that is no.
It's worth remembering that when everyone else of like the 14 people were out there selling memberships, Scheer basically campaigned to the base.
It worked.
Well, and the fact that he was like 51-49%, him and Bernier, is also telling, right? Mm-hmm. Like the people who voted for Bernier, you know, if there was that kind of split in the leadership race, not all of those people went to the PPC, right? So there's a lot of that constituency that's still.
I always say that Andrew Scheer is the best thing that ever happened to Justin Trudeau.
Squeezing that fish. I don't know who thought that was a good idea.
Moving on to quick takes. The final announcements for ride hailing have been released from the Passenger Transportation Board, who earlier this week announced several key regulations, most notably that ride-hailing companies are not going to have any caps on the number of drivers or limits to surge pricing.
I'm just going to put it out there that I'm generally cranky about the whole ride-hailing discussion.
There's no good.
There's not. I'm cranky about the model and about all of it. So, I mean, I thought that was interesting. I think that the regulations, once they were passed, you know, it is out of the hands of the government, right? So that was what they needed to do, the transportation minister, and then having it with a sort of arm's length transportation board. But yeah, I mean, I don't surge pricing. I don't agree with it. I don't, all of it, right? I think that we need to be moving away from car culture and investing in transit, and I'll stop there because
it is one of the more annoying conversations on Twitter. And I know that's saying something.
I 100% agree with you,
yeah. If it's one of the more annoying conversations on Twitter, that is, it's just, I feel like it's a very narrow demographic.
That's right.
That is actually impacted by this or cares about this, but they're very vocal and they wield a lot of power and influence. I don't, you know.
Not necessarily sure. I think like downtown Vancouver, it's fairly small, but
maybe.
Well, once you get outside of City of Vancouver, I think it's a lot bigger, but
I mean, I think a lot of the things that people want out of ride sharing in centers outside of Vancouver, they're also not going to get that. It's not going to deliver. There's transportation, transit gaps or transportation gaps for sure, right?
Yeah.
And I would not for a second defend the taxi industry either. I think they could have done a lot to end up in a different place here. But I don't know, again, with the no caps on pricing, with the, like, people are going to go, the service is going to be where people want to go to. And so getting a ride somewhere, you know, outside, far away.
From Mission to Pitt Meadows, right?
I don't know.
Yeah,
you know?
One of the other rules they brought in was there was going to be zones, like taxis have to operate in specific zones.
They do have that. It's just a lot bigger.
It's
yeah,
giant.
So
yes. There's like five in the province or something.
Yeah,
like
so
that.
Lower mainland is from like Hope to Squamish to the U.S. border,
right? Yeah.
And everything in between, versus a taxi company might be stuck to Surrey. So it's a very different model.
Well, taxis, they can't even go outside. Like the Vancouver, like they can't pick up.
The one-way trips.
Yeah.
And
the whole thing is so dysfunctional.
The argument that the board also made for not giving a cap was they figured, with the other restrictions in place, like class 4 licenses, that there won't be a huge uptick. So the fear of ride sharing, one of the fears is congestion, that you just put all these cars on the road, because a lot of the evidence from other municipalities shows it pulls people out of transit and into these small cars.
Because it services the same areas.
But it takes a while to get there. Yeah. So the board was like, maybe caps later. Let's not worry about it now. Let's not have that political battle out.
Yeah, so they did leave it open to revisions. But
And I think you made an excellent point, the political battle. And I think that's really what all of this is about, is that I think people are tired of talking about it. It's been talked about in political circles for years, and they just want to get it off the agenda. And it's like, to your point, we'll deal with the administrative and traffic headaches later.
And Lyft is already advertising in Metro Van.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what Uber does. Have they responded at all to the...
Not that I've seen
they're still
anything.
Upset about the class 4 licenses, I think.
The class 4 thing's fine.
Yeah,
totally.
They have it in other jurisdictions.
They require it too. Like,
honestly, we should make it harder to drive anyway. Just like
the
level of training you need to operate a vehicle is not high enough.
I agree.
But yeah, like a lot of that though, with the complaints about congestion and whatnot, are largely complaints about cars rather than this specific transportation model. And I do think a lot of the attention gets focused on ride hailing because it's new rather than it's the main problem.
Yes.
Well, we're obsessed with like apps and immediacy and convenience, right? And so in the race, it's not just ride hailing. Like ride hailing is, it's not what I'm most, you know, opposed to. It's the deregulation of things that have been, you know, we have safety regulations in place for reasons. We have, you know, business, like we have labor practice, you know, and so a lot of the models that we've seen with the gig economy, I don't like to call it the sharing economy because there's not a lot being shared other than people's labor for not a lot of, compensation. Anyways, I just think it's taking us backwards from where we need to go in terms of safety and labor regulations.
Well, moving from one of the, you know, talked about to death outside our circles topics here in BC to the other one is cannabis. And Shannon Waters has a nice piece up on British Columbia Today about the numbers behind BC's lagging cannabis sales. We've sold, I think we've talked about this a little bit before, but the piece is worth reading, so we'll link it in the show notes. But British Columbians have purchased just $9.3 million worth of weed officially. We know they've done a lot more.
This is the thing. You look at the numbers like in Alberta, and like this is not because all of a sudden British Columbians are smoking less pot. Like, this is like the consumption rates here relative to the rest of the country, I think, are likely to be the same. But people have their, it's been, it was a clunky roll. I mean, I think the rollout was fine, but there's still a lot of gaps in it in terms of availability and the product and the cost.
And the kinds of products.
And so people have already established relationships through which to acquire their cannabis products.
The infamous Betty and Sook.
There you go. Betty and Sook is probably...
Yeah, and from what I've heard, because I'm not a user, is that the stuff from Betty and Sook and other private or less than official dealers is generally better. So like, there hasn't been a big incentive for people to switch over.
It's cheaper anyways.
Yeah.
I've heard.
One of the other interesting things in here is that Shan seems to have figured out that the Liquor Distribution Board may have overstocked themselves initially.
They
bought a ton in October expecting a, you know, high demand, and the fear was there was going to be this massive run on cannabis and all the stores would run out.
The like one store they had open?
Yeah, so they got one store opening.
Stores, right? There's that, like, the whole distribution model is not functioning properly.
Well, and I think we really see that here in Vancouver in particular, because what happened over the last year was essentially most of the stores, already operating stores, never mind the Betty and Sook or the dealer,
but the storefronts.
The storefronts were closing down. So people actually have less options through the legalization process than they did a year ago, you know.
And that will change eventually. Yeah. I think this is the growing pains of getting a previously illegal industry. You legalize it and no one knows how to do any of it. And so we're kind of figuring it out.
I mean, I think it's like stepping back, it's a fascinating thing to sort of see the end of prohibition and how that's being grappled with. And,
well, none of that even touches on all the federal restrictions that kind of precluded a lot of people who were the experts.
Yeah. Well, this is it. The people who are already profiting off of the legalization are, in too many situations for my liking, people who previously were in enforcement roles or were responsible for penalizing people who use. So, I mean, there's a lot of equity pieces there as well in terms of who has historically borne the brunt of the war on drugs. And those are not the same people who are benefiting from ending the prohibition, unfortunately.
Well, moving on to yet another perennial topic in BC, Trans Mountain has announced that they're going to be starting construction as they issued notices to proceed to their various contractors, which means in 30 days, in theory, shovels are going to be hitting the ground.
This was expected. So it's not really a surprise. I think reading it, Burnaby is already back at work and people are going to be working there, which is, I guess, good news for the people in the construction industry who've been on kind of a hiatus and wondering what the status of that contract and that job would be. But for much of Vancouver, it means back to the protest lines.
Yeah. I mean, it was Trudeau who said that only communities can grant permission,
consent or something.
I think he had social license. Well defined.
And so, I mean, I don't think, you know, again, the province itself is split. I think there is a majority in support of the pipeline proceeding, but certainly the people in Burnaby, the Tsleil-Waututh, the people at the end of the line in
at
a very
end of the pipe,
densely populated area are opposing. Yeah, I can't see all of a sudden people just not continuing to put their bodies in the line. You know, they have been. Also, you know, see how it plays. I think it's interesting that that Trudeau, like, they obviously had some role in the timing of this.
They wanted to take off this box before the election.
They're doubling down and they're pursuing this at the start of an election, which indicates to me that they feel like they have the support on that to proceed.
I think it plays well for the Liberals in a lot of different parts of Canada, but it does put people like Terry Beach in North Burnaby.
Particularly Terry Beach.
And Joyce Murray as well, you know. And
She's a hard one to knock off.
Yeah, she's fairly secure.
Yeah, I don't know who's running with the conservative. Well, a strong enough conservative could take her out. That riding has gone conservative historically.
I think back in the days of
Campbell was, I think, the last conservative.
Was it really that long ago? Okay.
It might have been.
But Terry Beach for sure. And he's up against Finn Robinson too. So that's going to be
And
interesting.
I think the Greens have a strong candidate.
They have they have a young one. Yeah, they do.
The depressing truth is, I think the Liberals, they're kind of, in some ways, they're writing us off, British Columbia off in some ways. You know, they're like, they're rolling the dice and they think they can win this one. So,
well, and the other story that kind of comes up against this is the one that was in the news all week, which is that the Amazon is on fire, and not the warehouses that...
The wrong Amazon, as some people have said.
That have all the, like, Twitter bots that say their working conditions are great.
That can't go, we can go to the washroom whenever we want.
No, the one that gives all the oxygen to the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting story, because it came out... I mean, I just saw it a couple days ago, and the initial reaction I think that everybody had was wildfires, forest fires... Climate change, this is devastating. And it, of course, it is devastating. It's like, it's important. It's important. Yes. But as this, as I looked into the story more, it actually was, there's a back and forth as to who's igniting the fires. And the indigenous people there say that it's being done deliberately to clear the land for cattle production. Bolsonaro says that indigenous people are lighting the fire, or his opponents are lighting the fires and blaming him. So
it's, noted truth teller and like well, all around reasonable guy, Jair Bolsonaro.
This is exactly it. So it's gross. Anyway, you cut it. It's devastating. But it wasn't. I was sort of taken aback. You know, my initial response was different than what the story actually looks to be. So
yeah, it's pretty terrifying. I think that also what I found most interesting is the almost universal cry of people was, it's getting no media attention. It's getting no media attention. It actually is getting a lot of media attention. So I'm like, I think we have to stop about that. And we as British Columbians, we know this terror. We've lived through it for the last couple of years in some communities in British Columbia, very similar kind of situation that the sun was blotted out, you know.
Yeah, there's pictures from Sao Paulo today that looked like Vancouver last year.
Yes, or and Kamloops, Prince George, they were like in the middle of the day, it was dark. I mean, this is terrifying stuff, and it hits really close to home. And I think we all feel very fortunate that we've had more rain this year and not the kind of wildfires that we've seen before. But I think this is just yet another of many wake-up calls around the climate emergency. And, you know, we mentioned on our last podcast that there's one gratifying thing to come out of all of this is that the climate emergency and what to do about it is becoming front burner on a political level in a way that it really hasn't until now. And for that, I'm grateful, at least.
Yeah, there does seem to have been a mood shift in the last year, 18 months.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
I think here, the forest fires this summer, I mean, that was big.
Really brought it home for us in a very literal way.
A lot of people. Yeah.
Well, I want to end with one last lighter story, at least for us, but probably not for the person involved. Michael Miller was at the appeals court recently, and things didn't go his way. Michael Miller was arrested and convicted of basically fraud for an organization called Paradigm Education Group, where, you know, they ended up getting charged with $24,000 tax evasion. He appealed his conviction, as is his right, on the basis that the courts have no jurisdiction to
There wasn't gold
him.
Trim on the flag or any of the
I
other
think
sovereign
his,
citizens.
They didn't put all his name in brackets or something like that. And so he goes to the appeal court, self-represented, of course. Things don't go his way very quickly. As Bethany Lindsay in CBC points out, the unanimous ruling, you know, they knocked down every one of his random arguments. And also...
Because he's a natural person. Is this the,
natural person type thing. The Freeman on the land.
I'm using
Freeman.
Air quotes for those who can't see me.
My favorite part is how the Court of Appeal justices didn't even ask the Crown to present arguments to debunk him. They just said, no, these are bad. Go away. Stop wasting all our time. And so every lawyer was having fun reading that this week because they've all dealt with one of these, I think.
For sure. Yeah.
What happens next?
He might go to the Supreme Court of Canada because he...
Will they grant leave, though, or...?
I don't know how it works with criminal cases. In some cases, there's some rules about, like...
Yeah, what point are you wasting time, you know? Like, that's the... Especially if it's just shut down so much at this level.
We'll have to get a lawyer on, but I don't think there's an automatic appeal on this one, Supreme Court. I don't know. Maybe they'll just send back a note, just, ha-ha, no.
The best place for Freeman on the Land content is there was an Alberta there was an Alberta court who just like got so tired of this that eventually, and I forget the name of the case, it's a like family dispute where the name is the same on, you know.
Yeah, we talked about it,
before.
We'll link to that episode.
But it's basically just an essay written by the judge, hundreds of pages on why this ideology is nonsense.
Wow.
And he just was like, I need to do this as a favor for the rest
just
of...
Just so that there's precedent, so that there is some kind of document people can refer to try and minimize how much time is wasted and...
Well, and this is the thing that keeps coming up for me, because you hear these people who complain about human rights tribunals and people who are abusing the process there. And I'm like, people abuse all our courts.
Yeah.
That's not an argument against courts.
Exactly.
No one argues against the Court of Appeal because this guy was there. But if this guy was at the Human Rights Tribunal, they'd be like, well, we better get rid of those kangaroo courts. And you're like,
no.
Thank you both so much for joining us. Tell people once again where to find you and your podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having us. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Call the Q Podcast.
And at boltcommunications.com, B-O-L-D-T, communications.com. Thanks for having us today. It was fun.
Thank you. Well,
thanks for joining us. And that has been Politos. Find everything we talked about at politos.ca. For a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politos. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Napotnikov. Thanks for listening.